Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to one of my favorite parts of the week, which is book picks. Every Tuesday, we get two booksellers together or two bookstores together. Sometimes there can be multiple booksellers per store. It is up to them. And they come and they tell us about cool things that are on their shelves or will be on their shelves soon. We have a great group this morning. Giovanni Bovin is with us from the Book Loft in Great Barrington, the owner of that establishment. Good morning. How are you?
Cold. Ready for spring.
Yeah, it is cold, yep. But I'm glad you will warm us with your ideas here, sir.
Oh, hopefully.
Lily Bartels is with us from Open Door Bookstore in Schenectady, New York. Hello, Lily. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. How are you doing?
I'm well. Good to have you both here. Thank you very much. Let us begin with Giovanni. And where would you like to start?
All right, we're going to start with one of my new staff picks that just came out today. It's Diavola by Jennifer Thorne. And this is just such an iconic horror story with a beautiful background setting, this 500-year-old villa outside a village in Tuscany. Throw in a dysfunctional family and poltergeist, and you've got yourself pretty much a perfect recipe for a really good book. We've got our
mixed stir and joy,
or my childhood, as I'd like to call it.
We've got our main character Riley, who just wants to enjoy the Italian art and architecture. Her mother, who wants everyone to get along. Her father, who just wants to be left alone and read his books, but also reminding everybody who paid for this trip. Her older sister and her family, who literally has an itinerary for the entire trip. We're going to do this on this day. We're going to go there on that day. And her twin brother, who just is seeking everybody's approval. And his new boyfriend, who doesn't really seem to care what anybody thinks. And again, throw in a 500-year-old poltergeist, and you're going to have a fun trip.
Jennifer Thorne is the author. Diavola is the name of the book. Lily, you're up.
I'm going to start with a new book called The Titanic Survivors Book Club by Timothy Shaffert. And despite the title, this is not your typical cheesy Titanic-based story. And in fact, you don't really have to know much or care much about the Titanic tragedy to thoroughly enjoy this excellent novel. So the survivors of the title are not people who were on the Titanic and survived, but people who were supposed to be on the ship and for one reason or another never made it on board. So there is Yorick, who is the narrator of the story. He had been hired by the White Star Line to curate the second class passengers library. At the last minute, he's bumped by one of his superiors, and he's left stranded on the dock. There's also a woman named Zinnia, very glamorous, very wealthy. She's the heir to a confectionery fortune. She's traveling with her parents. When they get to the ship, and it's realized that her mother is Japanese, they are refused admission to the first class passenger section. So after the ship does sink, Yorick takes this twist of fate as kind of a sign that he should pursue his lifelong dream of opening a bookstore in Paris. So he does. And shortly after he opens it, he receives an invitation from this secret society of other ticket holders who didn't board the ship. And they've come together to form a book society to read and discuss and debate certain books that they hope will help them work through their guilty feelings, their survivor's guilt, their anxiety. You know, they're tortured by all of this. So of this diverse group, Yorick is particularly drawn to Zinnia, this very glamorous woman. But he's also attracted strongly to a mysterious man named Hayes. And in Hayes, he detects a secreted queer man like himself.
Mm-hmm.
So he begins to fall in love with Hayes. Hayes, in the meantime, is pursuing Zinnia. So you've got this kind of tangled triangle that develops, and the story is about how all the permutations of that will evolve and what will happen. At the same time that this is happening, World War I is starting to ramp up in Europe. And so when one of the society's members unexpectedly dies, it leaves the remaining members of the society wondering what fate that saved them from this tragedy might have in store for them. So as you can see, it is a very different take on the Titanic story. It's deeply researched. Timothy Shaffer is just like a dazzling writer who's created this exquisite historical novel. It is about love. It is about fate. But most important for me, it's about the power of books to bring people together and to change lives.
Great, certainly great thing there. The name of the book is The Titanic Survivors Book Club by Timothy Shaffer. Giovanni.
Next up, we've got one of Sherry's picks that came out just beginning of this month. It is Anita De Monti Laughs Last by Xochitl Gonzalez. I'm so glad she put in a pronunciation because yes. It's with an X. It's literally fiction.
Doesn't make anything easier.
Nope. It's literary fiction about two young Latina women, Anita De Monti in the 1980s art scene in New York and Raquel in the late 90s studying at Brown. And it sounds like this was inspired by the true story of a Cuban woman artist as well as the personal experiences of Xochitl when she was a student at Brown. Sherry says, you can feel the passion in this book. Each chapter pulses off the page. When I got to the end, I was tempted to go back to the first page and start all over again. It's a book that speaks so loudly about being seen, especially as Latina women, and staying true to yourself in a world that pushes for conformity.
An amazing, sounds amazing. It is Anita De Monti Laughs Last. All right.
So you say you like to see the books that I'm talking about.
I do.
This is the cover of James by Percival Everett.
I finished this last night at 7:33.
Joe, do you ever sleep?
Yes.
Sporadically.
But I would rather read this than sleep.
So James by Percival Everett. This is an extraordinary retelling of Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. It manages to stay true in the tone and the style to the original, but at the same time, it magnificently creates this alternative narrative that is completely different because Jim, or the James of the title, is the narrator, and that really sheds a different light on everything. So when the enslaved Jim hears that he's about to be sold to New Orleans, to a slaveholder in New Orleans, he realizes that that will mean, you know, separation forever from his wife and child. So he flees to a nearby island where he's going to hide out and try to formulate some sort of plan for himself and his family. In the meantime, Huck, as we know, has faked his own death to escape his abusive, violent father who's recently returned to town. So when Huck and Jim's, you know, paths cross, we know that that's the moment that sets in motion this dangerous trip down the Mississippi on a raft in search of freedom. So there are many of the narrative elements of the original book are here. They encounter the same storms, the same floods. They encounter unexpected death and also unexpected treasure in the various towns that they stop out along the banks of the Mississippi.
Huck's an address.
Yeah,
a lot of the time-honored traditions.
Right. They also encounter the same scam artists that were in the original book. So as it's told in James's from James's perspective, what's wonderful about it is that we get this view of this man as we see his intelligence, his compassion, his resourcefulness, it just shows him in a radically new light. We also see that James is a black man who has had to master projecting this stereotypical aspect of himself in order to get what he wants from the white people that are around him. He tells Jim how he's learned to speak quote-unquote slave talk when he's around white people in order for them to feel safe and superior. And he also reveals that he has, against the law, learned to read and that he's quite well-read and pretty well-read in all of the classics. So at the point where they embark on this raft trip, the story becomes very action-packed. It's exciting. It's suspenseful. It's harrowing. There's a lot more violence than in the original Huck Finn. But it also is very funny at times. And toward the end of the book, there is a completely stunning revelation that leads to a fantastic ending.
Absolutely. Agreed. It is Percival Everett's James, which is just out. The New York Times, in their review, says Huck Finn is a masterpiece. This retelling just might be too. Pretty good praise.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Giovanni.
Next up, we've got another one of my staff picks, Tusks of Extinction by Ray Naylor. And this is a quick little novella, but it ties together real current affairs, real science, the ivory trade, as well as the kind of cloning and genetic science of bringing back the woolly mammoth.
Mm-hmm. What could go wrong?
Well, that's what this book kind of explores is, you know, there is a scientist in Africa who is fighting against poachers for the last African elephants, and she's killed. And then several years later, they somehow perfect the technology. They revive the woolly mammoth by splicing the genetic coding into the last African elephants and try to establish a herd in Siberia. Meanwhile, you know, it explains, like, well, then what next? Like, okay, so you brought back this animal that's been extinct for thousands of years into a modern world that has no real frame of reference. And it's not even just the woolly mammoth because of the African elephant DNA spliced into it. So what they do is they take the consciousness of this elephant scientist who was murdered, implants it into one of the mammoths, and it's basically her job as a human brain consciousness in a woolly mammoth to teach woolly mammoths how to be mammoths.
Oh my God.
But that also kind of brings into the whole issue of, well, the ivory trade is still in demand. And actually, people are, to this day, out in Siberia digging through the tundra, searching for mammoth ivory as an alternative to African elephant ivory. So it brings in a lot of the kind of current affairs with the ivory trade, with the genetic science, and tying in the kind of moral quandary of, well, what next? How do we keep the mammoth from going extinct a second time due to human intervention? So like I said, this is a really short, really cool little novella. It's a quick read, but it really gets you thinking.
The name of the book is Tusks of Extinction by Ray Naylor. All right.
Well, I have brought this absolutely gorgeous book for you to see. And, of course, our listeners are at a disadvantage because they can't see it, but I'm going to describe it. It's a book called Unbound, Native Art of the Plains, and it's edited by a man named Emile Hermeni Horses. It's a book that celebrates the tradition of pictorial art among the native nations of the Great Plains. So among the people of the Great Plains, native warriors were also often artists, and they captured their experiences on shirts, robes, teepees, all made of buffalo hide. And the tradition began with their trying to replicate pictorially their visionary experiences. And then later, this moved on to create visual records of their battles and their hunts, their ceremonies, even their family lives. Then as trade expanded in the late 1800s, they had access to pencils and crayons and canvas and paper, and most importantly, ledger books, which they completely filled with these amazing drawings that chronicled their lives. It's just a stunning book, and again, it's frustrating because our listeners can't see it. But for instance, you see this ceremonial robe with these very intricate drawings that were done, you know, mid 1800s, and then you have pictures like these, which are so detailed, so colorful, and these are done in the ledger books. So what's interesting about this is that all of the art is presented in chronological order, but it's also juxtaposed with works by like 11 prominent contemporary Native artists that were commissioned by the National Museum of the American Indian to create art very much in the tradition of their ancestors. And they were all chosen from tribes that historically did create all of this pictorial art. It's just a beautiful book. You can pick it up. You can open it to any page and you'll be flabbergasted. You know, some may be tempted to refer to this art as primitive. I think it's very sophisticated. It's dynamic. It's use of, you can feel the movement. Gorgeous colors, intricately drawn. I mean, it really takes a very steady hand and eye to do this work. And it's an incredible tribute and legacy to these Native peoples of the Great Plains.
The name of the book is Unbound, Native Art of the Plains by Emil Hermini Horses, I should say, edited by. Excellent. Giovanni.
Next up, it's another Sherry staff pick. It is Grief is for People by Sloan Crosley. And this is a memoir. Sherry likens it to the same level of Joan Didion or Laurie Moore. And it tackles a very tough subject, that being the suicide of a colleague. But her sardonic wit and perfectly written sentences make it a less tough subject. It's honest. It shines the light on the complexity of what it is to be a friend, to be a human, and to grieve someone you know. She said she loved how we got a little taste of publishing behind the scenes, especially during a big snafu. One note to mention, she draws from genius writers in the book, using quotes in the most perfect of places. This has actually been a steady seller at our store, and I hope it continues to be a steady seller.
It's a beautiful book, and it's well done. She's been on the show, and it's a fascinating, tragic story, but a fascinating way of telling of that relationship, and not only putting two events together in Sloan's life. One was the robbery of her apartment, and the other is the suicide of her friend. So it's a fascinating look. I think we have time for one each.
Okay. I'm going to go with this novel called Clear by Karis Davies, an author that I was unfamiliar with, but I will be reading more of. You can see by the cover that it creates atmosphere right at the get-go. So it's a really spellbinding story. As I said, it's very atmospheric. It's set in Scotland in the 1840s. And it's about a minister named John who's broken free from the Church of Scotland along with some other ministers to form what was known as the Free Church. And this was in rebellion against the Church of Scotland and the pervasive control that Scottish landowners had over that church. But they have no funding. They can't pay these ministers any salaries. And so John and his wife Mary become impoverished. This is happening also during what's called the infamous Scottish clearances, where whole communities of rural poor were thrown off their lands, forcibly evicted, so that these wealthy landowners could have even more land for farming and grazing. So despite John's conscience and Mary's serious trepidation about John's taking on this job, he's offered a job by one of the landowners to travel to a distant Scottish island to evict the last remaining inhabitant, a man named Ivar, who has lived there by himself for decades. He's provided a gun in case Ivar won't comply. So he makes this trip, and shortly after he reaches the island, he falls from a cliff. He's seriously injured. He's unconscious, and Ivar finds him, takes him back to his dwelling, and proceeds to care for him and nurse him ever so slowly back to health, which takes a long time. The men have no common language, so Ivar starts to compile this dictionary. I'm sorry, John starts to compile this dictionary of Ivar's words so they can have some fundamental communication. And they begin to establish this sort of fragile, interesting, unique relationship. Meanwhile, Mary's back in Scotland. She's panicked because John hasn't returned home as planned. She sets off on a steamer, arrives at the island, and her arrival precipitates this completely unexpected situation, and eventually the three of them arrive at an ending that I'm going to cryptically say is also a beginning that completely took me by surprise, and I found it such a refreshing and satisfying ending. I love a story that is written with great sensitivity toward the nuance and the expansiveness that's capable between and among human beings, and this pays due respect to that. Very moving story.
All right, Giovanni, if you can wrap us up in 90 seconds, that'd be great.
Floating Hotel by Grace Curtis is very different for me. It is more of kind of a cozy. It is about this very large luxury cruiser, space cruiser, and each chapter is about a different either staff member or guest, starting with Carl, the hotel manager who has been on the hotel since he was 12 years old. So for 40 years, he's been managing this. And it is a fun read. There's a little bit of mystery, intrigue, a little bit of social commentary, especially with the Galactic Empire, and just came out, and I read this in like 2 days, so it's a really, really good read.
Those are great books to rip through and enjoy. The name, again, of the book is Floating Hotel by Grace Curtis. All right. We're out of time. I apologize. The full list will be on. Is there anything coming up in the story you want to mention real quick?
No.
Okay. Giovanni?
We're turning 50 this year, so Mother's Day weekend. Yeah, we'll have a little birthday bash in May.
Oh, that's fantastic. Congratulations. Yep. That's a wonderful achievement. All right. My thanks to our dear friends here from the Book Loft in Great Barrington, Giovanni Boven, as well as Lily Bartels from the Open Door Bookstore and Gift Gallery in Schenectady, New York. You can find out more about them by going to bookloft.com and opendoor-bookstore.com. And you can also see the entire list at wamc.org/roundtable. wamc.org/roundtable. A pleasure to have you both here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.